Hi, everyone. Welcome to tonight's class. It's great to see all of you. This is going to be the final class of our four-part series on the classes between Tanakh and Sfarim Bashana, the books written after the times of Tanakh, at times of the Bible, but before the times of Chazal, before the writing of the Mishnah, the Medrash, and so on. We've had a lot of fun, I hope. I know I've had a lot of fun preparing and teaching about these classes, going through works like the Apocrypha, Josephus, the Z Scrolls, and tonight's class, Megillat Tanit. I hope that you also felt excited about it, and hoping that you will take that energy that hopefully has been developed through this little mini-series that we did over the summer to decide to commit to partaking in one of our programs for next year. Next year we're going to be offering the Tanakh Bashana program again that we offered this past year, an opportunity to study all of Tanakh over the course of a year in a very meaningful, sophisticated, well-thought-out, curriculum-based manner. Different speakers, well-known educators that are partaking, that are going to be teaching in the program. Those who took it last year can tell you how excellent of a program it was, and you certainly will benefit and really find it's a worthwhile use of your time. There's sign-up sheets outside. If you sign up over the next month or so, there's an additional savings available, so I encourage you to take advantage of that and to sign up. You're going to be happy. You're going to be happy that you did. We're going to be starting at the end of October. In addition, we're launching a new program, Sfarim Bashana, where we're going to be studying the books from the times of the Medrash forward, the most important, or some of the most important books of our rabbis written over the past 2,000 years in areas of Jewish law, Jewish thought, Jewish biblical studies. And it will certainly give you a new appreciation, a new understanding of the development of the Jewish religion, Jewish practice, Jewish thought, and enable you to better understand Judaism and the ability to study Torah in a much more meaningful way from that time forward, having a sense of appreciation of the most important works written and oftentimes the most often quoted works from that period of time. And again, that's going to be offered next year, and really encourage you, take advantage. These are really it's a wonderful opportunity for you to really grow and to enrich your Jewish lives. And it's a big commitment, week in, week out. But as we did this past year, if you miss a week, that's okay. Sources are available, recordings of the class are available for you to make up your time. And if you can't make it every weekend, then okay, it's going to be hard. No, very few people made it every single week last year, but it was still a worthwhile use of their time. Hopefully you can make it to most of the classes and get a great deal out of participating. Again, there are sheets outside. Ruth can help you with that. So that you can sign up and get yourself set for next year already now. Along those same lines, we are going to have an opportunity to continue learning over the summer, over this coming month. Ruth doesn't even know about this yet. Over the coming month, we're going to have a chance to have a weekly class also on Wednesday nights. It's going to be an in-depth Tanakh class. It's going to be looking specifically at the story of the Garden of Eden. And in a more in-depth way. We have pleasure this summer, the next month, of having our Mark Fishman, who's sitting in the back over here. He's a student in Ephrata. He studies with Rabbi Riskin. And he's going to be here with us for the next few weeks, giving us an opportunity to learn and to study from him. So again, that's going to be on Wednesday nights over the next month, the next few weeks. If you're interested, let us know in the office. The class is free of charge. Let us know that you're planning to come. It's going to be a wonderful adventure. I would certainly say to the story of the first story of the Torah, that of the Garden of Eden. But to tonight's class, and tonight's final class of the books written between Tanakh and Chazal. First, I want to just thank our sponsors for this. We have drinks and some food. We thank them for that. To thank Lois and Leslie Katz, who are sponsoring this week for the yard site of Leslie's mother, Gudel Bas Yehuda. It should be an aliyah for her neshama, Yishkoch, for that sponsorship. Okay. Tonight's class, Megillat Tanit. Of all of the books that we've covered, this is the one book which is part of Jewish writings from that time. And I say Jewish, as we saw, all of them are written by Jews, but this is the one book that's made it into part of the Jewish tradition, into the way that Judaism has continued after the times of Vayicheni, the Second Temple period. This is the one book written during that time that's been preserved as part of our religious tradition. And in fact, it is quoted many times throughout the Talmud and then in Jewish literature as a source of information on Jewish history, but also for legal ramifications as well. While the Apocrypha, while Josephus, the Dead Sea Scrolls are important historically and they give us insight into religious life at that time, this one particular book has been embraced by Jewish history as continuing to be a part of our religious tradition. And so while perhaps it's one of the least known books that we're covering, it is one of the most perhaps important as far as Judaism ultimately is concerned. And so it's important. I was happy that we had the chance to do it. It's actually a quite short book. I just printed it out off of a online thing that I have, a Bar Ilan CD, just a few pages long. It's quite, this, you don't have this in your source sheet. This is, you have part selections of it in your source sheet, but it's a small book. In fact, it's known as a scroll. It's known as Megillat Ta'anit, the Scroll of Fasts. And that we're going to talk about exactly when it was written and who wrote it and those types of things. But just to give you a little bit of a sense, it is a scroll that talks about, not fasts, and we're going to actually talk about this issue in a minute, but it's a fast, it's a scroll that talks about days when one was not permitted to fast. It was days that were considered to be quasi-holidays, quasi-festivals. Not festivals like we might consider Sukkot and Pesach, days in which one is not permitted to even do creative labor, to do melacha, and so on, but quasi-holidays in the sense that one was not permitted to fast on those days. One was then allowed to mourn on those days. In fact, those were days that, on some of which one wasn't even permitted to give a hesped, to give a eulogy. They were quasi-holidays. And we actually have reference, and this is interesting, and sort of what we hope to do in this class is sort of make reference to things that we've touched on in the past few weeks and sort of see how they all come together, how they all can be used for enriching Jewish studies. And that was one of the things we wanted to focus on, is that in university, all of these books are studied, but they're not necessarily studied from the angle that we approach them at, is that of how, what impact do they have for Jewish studies, Judaica studies. And so we're sort of going to see that all come together tonight. So the first source I want you to look at is on the inside cover of your source booklets. And this is taken from one of the books of the Apocrypha, the Book of Judith. The Book of Judith, as you remember, was a story about a widowed woman who was considered to be a very pious individual who went on her own and took it upon herself to kill the general of the Babylonian army, that she seduces him and ultimately kills him in the process. So there's a reference towards the middle of the book that talks about her piety. And take a look at what it says. It says in source one, it says that she fasted all the days of her widowhood. She fasted every day, pious woman, except the day before the Sabbath and the Sabbath itself. Right? One isn't permitted to fast on Shabbat. The day before the new moon and the day of the moon, on Rosh Chodesh. Right? She wouldn't fast on Rosh Chodesh either. And the festivals on Pesach, Sukkot, and so on. And the days of rejoicing of the house of Israel. Here you have an additional comment of the days of rejoicing. And it's understood that what does it mean the days of rejoicing is different than the festivals, that the days of rejoicing are referring to the days enumerated in Megillat Ta'anit, in the book of fasting, the book in which one was not permitted to fast, days in which they were considered to be somewhat holidays, somewhat festivals, somewhat to be days of rejoicing. And as we discussed in that previous class, this is a Book of Judith is probably written sometime around the time of the Second Temple period, likely during the times of the Maccabees in the second century before the Common Era. And so it refers to this scroll, which is a scroll unique to the Second Temple period. Okay, so it is quite ancient. Now, what's interesting is that when we hear the reference to Megillat Ta'anit, the Scroll of Fasts, What comes to mind is, or what I think you'd probably first assume is, these are days on which you're supposed to fast. And it's not surprising that you would think that, but actually that's a translation, literal translation. In fact, there is a Jewish book known as Megillat Ta'anit, which is days when you are supposed to fast. And because of that, there in fact has been confusion. Now we appreciate that they are really two separate works, but there was in fact confusion over the course of Jewish history between these two particular books. And I want you to take notice. You look in source number 2 in your booklet, under the heading Confusion Surrounding the Scroll. This is a quote from the Shulchan Aruch from the 16th century, Rabbi Yosef Cairo. We'll learn about him in Sfarim Bashana, but one important works of Jewish law. And he writes over here, he says, Elu hayavim she'iru b'hem tsaro la'avotenu. These are the days when tragedies occurred to our ancestors. The ra'oi l'hitanot b'hem, and so it is appropriate for a person to fast on those days. But afal peshe mitzatzam Rosh Chodesh, even though some of these would in fact even fall out on Rosh Chodesh, a day when typically we do not fast, yesh misha omer shid'anu bo, there are still those that say that it is appropriate to fast because of the tragedies that occurred during this time. Here we don't have reference to the name of the book, but one of the important commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, one of the super commentaries, that of the Magen Avraham, written in the 17th century, and he writes, Dekasa v'atanya nishalu ha-ga'onim ala ha-taniyot elu. That the Ga'onim lived in the early part of the medieval period, the 8th, 9th, 10th century of the Common Era. So the Ga'onim were asked about these days. V'heshivu lo yadanu mitaknam. They said, we don't know. We don't know where these mourning days, where these days of fast came from. They're interesting. If you look in the list, we have a list of these days. There are days that have to do with, this is the day that Moshe died, this is the day that so-and-so died, this is the day that happened. Different events that took place on those days. And so it was considered appropriate that one should fast, sort of express mourning on those days. But the Gaonim said, we don't know where they came from. We don't know. We have this list of days where it's appropriate to fast, but we don't know where they came from. So the Magen Avraham said, since we don't really know where these come from, if you want to fast on them, fine, but it's not appropriate to fast on Rosh Chodesh. That's what the Gaonim said. He quotes other books that say this, that those that say that they've never seen anyone in fact fast on those days. I've never seen anyone who fasted on them. Aval, when here the Magen Avraham chimes in, he says, even though we don't know where these days came from, in fact, there are those who said they never saw anyone fast on those days. He says, Aval anira iti shekodvim b'sefer Megillat Ta'anit. But he says, I found this in the scroll in Megillat Ta'anit. Imkei nitkana b'mei chachmei ha-tamud. And therefore, it must be that these days were established during the times of the Talmud. The Gam, Bahar Katvam, and also the Baal Halachot Gedolot, again, someone from the period of the early medieval period, he also writes about the importance of these days where one is supposed to fast, and Shekol Devarav Divrei Kabbalah, and everything that the Bahag writes, he says, we know, has a strong tradition behind it. And therefore, every pious individual should try to be stringent upon themselves, if possible, and to fast on those days. And so his basis, his reasoning for saying that these are serious fast days, or at least that they're appropriate fast days, is the fact that he found them in Megillat Ta'anit. Now, as we mentioned, Megillat Ta'anit is a day of is a scroll of holidays, days in which you're not supposed to fast. But he said he found these days in which you're supposed to fast, within that scroll. So what exactly is going on? Clearly they're different. So what apparently happened is that both of these became known as Megillat Ta'anit. Both of these. And at some point, publishers put them together and said, let's just make them into one book. And so the first half of the book would be the days on which you're not supposed to fast, and the second half were days which you're supposed to fast. They're clearly mutually exclusive works because there's days that contradict each other. There are days that say you should fast, and there are the same days that say you shouldn't fast. But because of that, because they were published together, this Magen Avraham, living in the 17th century, understandably became confused and thought they both came from the same source, that they both were quite ancient, while in fact, our Megillat Tanit that we're talking about does have a very old tradition, but these days on which you're supposed to fast, that's a later tradition. It's unclear exactly where those dates came from. There's an interesting piece that Professor Lyman has written trying to identify the significance of each of those dates. But what we're going to focus on is the true Megillat Tanit, the true book of fast, the true book of days that you're not supposed to fast upon. Okay? Okay. Fine. So that's a little bit of the background and sort of the confusing nature of the name of the scroll itself. In fact, two scrolls, but let's just keep focused. And we're talking about days that were holidays during the Second Temple period. Sorry? Geonim again is mentioned. Those are where rabbis lived in the early medieval period. Okay. Particularly in Babylonia. Okay. So what's in this book? Why are these days considered to be holidays? What exactly is going on? So there's 36 days mentioned in Megillat Tanit, 36 days in which a person is not supposed to fast, and perhaps a person should not even eulogize during those days. And there's a number of different things that occurred that made these into days that the rabbi felt it was appropriate to celebrate, in a sense, during those days. Some of which were of a military political nature, some of which are of a religious social nature. Those of a political nature deal with victories, military victories that occurred during that time period, half of which almost are those of the period of the Maccabees, starting with the episode of Hanukkah. But then, as we mentioned last week, the Maccabees then ruled from 165 BCE all the way till the time of the Romans, about 70 or so BCE. I don't have the date in front of me. And number of military victories, and we'll look at it later in the class, of victories that occurred during that time, and it was designated that these should be days of celebration. In addition to those days, you also have victories that took place over the Romans. Ultimately, were defeated by the Romans. The base of the division is destroyed in 70 of the Common Era. But during that time period, there were small victories that took place. A time where the Romans were pushed out of Jerusalem. A time where taxes that the Romans had imposed were thrown off. And those days were established as days of celebration, as the days of festivals. In addition to that, though, we also have days that are celebrations that deal with infighting. And from this, we really get a sense of why it became part of the lasting Jewish tradition, because the infighting deals with days where the Perushim, where the Pharisees, the Jews of that time who we descend from, had victories over other Jewish sects of those times, that of the Tzedukim, that of the Sadducees, that of the Kutim, sort of a derogatory term for the Samaritans. And we'll look at some of those sources, but times where we had victories over them, over power struggles, as it were, for who would be the ones to determine the religious nature or the governing nature of the Jewish community during the period of Bayit Sheni. Most of the dates, as we mentioned, deal with the period of the Maccabees and onward, though there are a couple of dates that predate the Maccabees as well. Important dates that are on there that predate the Maccabees are that of an important date that takes place in Adar, Purim. Purim is in there. And we also have an important date in there that takes place in Iyar, on the 14th of Iyar. Pesach Sheni, right? Pesach Sheni, that was the time when Jews were permitted to come, and if they hadn't had a chance to bring the sacrifice on Pesach itself, they could bring the sacrifice, the Korban Pesach, the Paschal offering, on a month later, on the 14th day of Iyar. And so that was also considered a somewhat of a holiday, a day which you shouldn't fast. Some of these, as we're going to see, continue to be observed today, some as holidays. Some of these no longer are considered to be holidays today and are no longer observed. And we'll talk about that towards the end, about exactly what happened to the celebration of these 36 days and why most of them are no longer celebrated. Okay. So why don't we spend just a minute? I just want to talk about a little bit about one of those references that I mentioned. Something we didn't get a chance to talk about, we sort of made reference, is that there were many different groups of Jews living in Israel during the times of Bayit Sheni. We spoke about them, but we spoke about the group that lived in Qumran. We spoke about exactly who they were. Perhaps they're the Essenes. We spoke about the Tzedukim, the Sadducees. We talked about the Kutim, the Samaritans. Just wanted to spend just a minute talking on exactly who these groups were. The Kutim are interesting because they actually date to Bayit Rishon. They date to the First Temple period. Our tradition says that they were a mixture of Jews who perhaps were leftovers from the original 10 tribes, together with those who had been brought in from outside of Israel when the king of Babylonia tried to sort of mix up the nations as a way of helping us to lose Jewish identity. And so there sort of became a group that was quasi-Jewish, considered themselves to be Jewish. Perhaps there was some type of forced conversion that took place. But at the same time, the rabbis of the Talmud always referred to them that they felt they weren't authentic Jews, and that their traditions were not authentic, and that there were even groups among them who continued to engage in idol worship. And there were became really, at that time already, really considered to be independent groups and not part of Jews. You know, you do it this way, we do it that way, but really that these are Jews and these were not Jews. And as we're going to see in some of our sources, there were great battles that took place. There were times that even during times of battles between Jews and the Romans, Jews and the Greeks, that the Kutim, as they became known as a derogatory term, in fact, enabled and helped and facilitated the attacks of the Greeks and the Romans against the rest of the Jewish population. And so there really was a major schism between those two groups. During the times of Hanukkah, we are familiar with the group called the Mityavnim, the Jews who became enamored with Greek society, and in fact began to identify themselves as Greeks, and that they there too enabled the Greeks within their influence over the rest of the Jewish population. Ultimately, when the Maccabees defeat the Greeks, they also, and we'll see sources of referring to this event, they set out to defeat the Mityavnim as well. And in fact, there was even a killing of those who had abetted the Greeks during their attacks, during their fighting with the Maccabees. After that period, we no longer hear of the Mityavnim. What all of a sudden we start hearing about are the Tzedukim, are the Sadducees. So some suggest that perhaps there already was somewhat of a movement of Sadducees predating the story of Hanukkah, but they really pick up strength after the story of Hanukkah, perhaps in part by all these former Mityavnim now joining on to the Sadducees. Where the Sadducees are different is that the Sadducees say, we're Jews. We believe in Judaism. We just interpret Judaism differently than you, Purushim. And so while it sort of failed, this secular Jewish movement of the Mityavnim, a new Jewish movement tried to take hold, that of the Sadducees, that again also was different than the tradition of the Purushim, the Pharisees of the rabbis, who we come from. But instead of totally throwing off a more Jewish approach, they said, we're going to continue to be Jews, but we're going to do it in a different way, some of which perhaps was a more permissive type of Jewish observance. There was a lot of discussion about that specifically. And so then there are great debates, and the Tzedukim are quite strong. We spoke about that last week. The Tzedukim are part of the aristocracy. Many of them are part of the priestly group, the Kohanim, and so they are a part of the leadership of that time. And it wasn't simply a small group, but it could be, in fact, they were half of the population at certain times. And we even have sources that they sat on the Sanhedrin. But they were a major religious force in Israel at that time. In fact, one of the days of celebration is the days when the Sadducees were finally removed from the Sanhedrin. So I just want to read to you that one particular source. This is dated to be on the 28th day of Teves. This is not in your source sheets. It says Why was this a day of celebration? It says, Mimnesha hayu hatzidukin yoshin b'Sanhedrin. That the Tzidukim, the Sadducees, were part of Sanhedrin. One of the later kings of the Maccabees was a person named as Yanai. Yanai is, well, the Maccabees we celebrate as the victors. The Maccabees as the great victors and the heralds of Jewish strength. They don't stand up. They fought against assimilation, against acculturation, but ultimately they too acculturate and become and lose their commitment to Jewish practice. In fact, one of the people most famous and really reviled within the Talmud is that of Yanai HaMelech, who in fact killed many of the sages at that time. One of the sages that survives is Shimon ben Sheta, perhaps the brother-in-law of Yanai HaMelech. Lots of questions exactly what it is, but this is, again, this is talking about the end of the 2nd century, the beginning of the 1st century BCE in Israel. Again, more probably the beginning of the 1st century BCE, around, let's say, 80 BCE. And so it talks about that the Tzedukim were Yoshim v'Sanhedrin, and that Yanai HaMelech was Shlom Tzion HaMalka Yoshevet Etzlo. That the queen was Shlom Tzion. She ultimately will take over for Yanai after his death. She's known as Salome the Queen. She is someone who very much had a great affinity for the Pharisees, and that's a time of great influence of Purushim in Israel. And it says that the only person that was with him was Shimon ben Shetach among the Sanhedrin. It says, V'hayu sholim tshuvot v'alacha v'lo hayu yodin l'havi raya min haTorah. And there were those who brought questions to the Sanhedrin. It says that the people sitting on the Sanhedrin didn't know how to answer. They didn't know how to bring proof from the Torah as to exactly how to adjudicate the matters. So Amar Lam Shimon ben Shetach. So Shimon ben Shetach said, "Kol mi shehu yodei alav yiraya min haTorah, kasher liyashiv b'Sanhedrin." It says, anyone who can bring proofs from the Torah, you are worthy of being a member of the Sanhedrin. But if not, then get off. So Pam Acha Nafal Davar Shalmasa b'Neim. There once was a matter of practical ramifications. Lo yal yodei alav yiraya min haTorah, and no one could bring a proof. Except there was one that said, no, give me a day. Let me go check it out. But he couldn't give an answer. So, and he could not find a proof. The next day he was too embarrassed to come to court, and so he didn't show up. And Shimon Shetach says, we've got an empty slot over here. He took one of his students and sat him on the Sanhedrin. He said, you can't have less than 71 people sitting on the Sanhedrin. I need to fill the spot, the vacancy. And it says that's what he did, day in, day out. Until he had totally resat the entire Sanhedrin from his students, from those of the Pharisaic tradition. The day on which this change took place, Asu Yom Tov, was declared to be a holiday, was declared to be one of these days in which one should not fast. So contained within these days are days of religious turmoil as well, not only political victories, not only military victories, but religious victories as well. So clearly this is a text of the Purushim, as opposed to some of the other texts we had spoken about where we said it's unclear exactly which Jews were writing it. This clearly was written by Purushim, and so it was maintained and continued to be preserved as an important book, even after the times of Bayecheni, and it finds itself referred to in the Mishnah, and it finds itself referred to in Medrash, and finds itself referred to within the Talmud, within the Gemara as well. Okay. So moving on. There's a number of issues that we need to talk about. So what exactly is this scroll? One of the things we need to look at is exactly what the structure of this scroll is. I want you to open up your source booklet, please, to page 3. Let's look at source number 8. We're going to look at it more in depth a little bit later, just for purposes of appreciating exactly how the Megillah works. I need you to look, though, into the Hebrew side to fully appreciate this. So you're welcome to look at the English as well. It says right after the slashes, it says Bitlat Asar Be Yom Nikanor. On the 13th day is the day of Nikanor. It then says Amru Nikanor Shalmach Yavin Haya Over. Now, it then talks about what exactly took place on that day. Look at the previous paragraph. Look at source 7. Look at source 7. Again, after the slashes, it says, the Esrin v'timnei bay eats natal Antiochus Malka Yerushalayim. On the 28th day of Shabbat, King Antiochus was removed from Jerusalem. Shehayu Yerushalayim, then it explains what in fact took place. Shehayu Yerushalayim, and it tells you what happened. If you notice, well, there's two different languages that we're reading from. The heading, the date is written in Aramaic, but then the description of what took place on that day is written in Hebrew. If we were to say the 28th day in Hebrew, how would we say it? Esrin v'shmona. But how does it write it here? Esrin v'timne. Right, that's an Aramaic way of saying 28. Or look again at 8. If we were to say 13, how would we say 13 in Hebrew? Right, Shloshasar. But here, what does it say? Betlatasar. Again, it's using an Aramaic. As opposed to then the body, the major paragraph where it really goes into the description, is written in Hebrew. And so that has enabled scholars to identify that, in fact, there are two parts to Megillat Ta'anit. There is a part that is quite old, and there is a part that is not as quite old. Now, we would say, so which part is really old? The Hebrew, right? From Israel. And Aramaic, then we would think that's like the Gemara, so that should be later. But in fact, it's the opposite. In fact, it's the opposite. That it's the part that's written in Aramaic, which is extremely old, and again, we have to talk exactly how old, but there's the Aramaic, which is very old, and the Hebrew is not quite as old. Already in the times of the Second Temple period, certainly in the later parts of it, the language which is spoken in Israel is not Hebrew, but it's referred to as a Palestinian Aramaic. It's a version of Aramaic. That was the spoken language. Now, while we have afterwards, and again, this is something you're going to learn about next year, and starting Bashna, while the Mishnah is written in a language, the Talmud is written in Aramaic, in Babylonian Aramaic, for the Babylonian Talmud. The Mishnah, which predates the Talmud, is written in what language? In Hebrew. Why is it written in Hebrew? It's written, where is the Mishnah written? It's written in Israel. But it's not written in Hebrew because that was the language that was spoken. It's because that was the language of the rabbis. That was the way that we wrote down our legal writings. It's interesting why the Talmud is not written in Hebrew, and that's something you'll hopefully have a chance to learn about next year. But typically when Jews write literature pertaining to Torah, we do it in Hebrew. We do so in Hebrew. And so the Mishnah is written in Hebrew, and the explanations, therefore, which come a little bit later, the explanations date after the times of the Second Temple period, those are written in Hebrew. That which is written in Aramaic, the headers, was from the times of the Second Temple period. And why are they written in Aramaic? Because the point was, these are the days where people were not allowed to fast. And they wanted people to have in front of them the calendar that they could look at and say, oh, it's the 13th day of Adar. I'm not allowed to fast today. So it had to be written in a language that was the language of the people. However, the explanations that come later seem to have not been written down for the purpose of that people should open up a calendar and see what they're supposed to do, but was written down to explain what exactly the meaning of those dates were. And so that aspect was written in the Hebrew that was written down among like the times of the Mishnah. Okay, so when we talk about that Megillat Ta'anit comes from the time of Bayit Sheni, we're actually just talking about the list of dates. Sometimes the list of dates also make a small reference to what that date is about, but the long explanations that follow in Megillat Ta'anit, in these pages that I have here, are written after the times of Bayit Sheni. And which also then causes scholars to question how much veracity, how much authenticity can we attribute to the explanations of those dates. A lot of work has been done on them and has found that, in fact, there is some important information that is found there. As we'll see, the reason that some people have been found to feel comfortable with those explanations because they found other references to those days within other books, like the Book of Maccabees and so on. And for the dates that they can't find additional proof for, they don't necessarily accept. But again, as part of our tradition, we do accept these explanations and appreciate that they do express some inkling into what in fact happened on those days. Okay. So when exactly was this written then? So it's a good question. So based on what we said tonight, when you say this is written? Anyone? Right, because it's referring to dates that are written that are referred to there. Right, so some say, oh, sorry, after the period of the Hashmonaim, right, the Maccabees, the Hasmoneans, right, that's got to be the time when this was put together because it refers to those dates. And so, in fact, while the dates refer to it, there's one question is, when were these dates set up? So they probably were set up as things occurred. But there's another question of, well, when was it actually written down? When was it written down? And for that, there's a number of different opinions suggested for when it was written down. Some say it was already began to be written down at the period of the Maccabees, and it was simply added onto as they went along. Some say, no, it was written down after the period of Maccabees, during the period of the Romans, perhaps specifically before the time of the Korban. We're going to look at that. And some say, no, it's written after the Korban, but everyone agrees the latest it could have possibly been written was the time of the Bar Kokhba rebellion, right? 130 of the Common Era is the latest that it would have been written down. But again, even though the dates may have been written down at a later point, they refer to events that took place during Bayit Sheni, though there may be one or two, it's unclear, in fact, even occur after the period of Bayit Sheni and become part of this scroll of days of celebration. We do have one tradition, though, within the Talmud as to the source and the authorship of this particular scroll, which has inspired some scholars to suggest why this scroll was written. And they give an interesting insight into the scroll. So look at the bottom of page number one, source number four. This is under the heading Authorship and History of Scroll. So this is the Gemara in Shabbos. It says, Tanur Rabbanan, the rabbis taught, Mi katav Megillat Tanit. Good question. Who wrote Megillat Tanit? So Amru, they said, Hananya ben Chizkia b'siyata. Who wrote it? Hananya, the son of Chizkia, and his helpers. We'll talk about that in a second. It's interesting what it writes over here. Shehayu mechavid et hatzarot. Because they cherished the troubles. What does that mean? They cherished the troubles? Meaning, they remembered the victories. Meaning, they remembered the hard times, and therefore they celebrated the happy occasions that occurred afterwards. Not that they loved, troubles, but they loved the fact that we came out of troubles. Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, Shimon Gamliel said, he lives at a later time. He lives at a later period. We'll talk about that later period. But he says, "Af anu mechabin et hatzarot." He says, "We also cherish the troubles of amana aseh." But what can we do? Meaning, the reason that we don't make a holiday every time that we have some type of change of fate, some positive event, is she'im banu lichtov enanu maspik. He says, "Because there's too many to count. There's too many to count. It will become overwhelming, and therefore." We don't do this anymore. Okay. So just focusing on Hananya ben Chizkia. So just look back at the next page, source 5. This is the Mishnah that the Gemara was commenting on in Shabbos. The Mishnah says, Elu mim, and we're going to try to figure out who he is. Does anybody know? Where does he live? So we're going to identify. When does he live? So the Elu min alachot sh'amru ba'aliyat Hananya ben Chizkia ben Garon Sha'alu Levakro. These are the laws, the mission says, about to tell you, the laws that we're about to state are laws that were decided in the upper chamber, perhaps in the attic, of Hananiah, the son of Chizkiah, the son of Garon, because the sages went, to visit him up in his attic. Nimnu v'rabu Beit Shammai al Beit Hillel. That time, because they all got together, there were more numerous those of the students of Shammai over the students of Hillel, and so they were able to push some laws through. Typically, we say that we paskin like Beit Hillel over Beit Shammai, that we follow the tradition of Beit Hillel over Shammai, but it says that this one particular time in history, this one moment, perhaps this one day, they got together, and in that room there were more students of Shammai than students of Hillel. They took a vote, and they were able to pass certain laws through, and these laws become famous within Talmudic tradition as it says over here, Shmonasar Dvarim Gazru Bayom, as the 18 enactments. They passed through 18 laws at that time. And so the period that we're talking about is when? Is this time of the students of Hillel and Shammai. Now Hillel and Shammai are referred to in Perkei Avot. What are they referred to as? The Zugot, the pairs. When do they live? How do we refer to them? What period are they in? What do we refer to as Shammai and Hillel? We call them the Tanaim, right? The part of the period of the Tanaim, but they're very early Tanaim. Tanaim dates after the period of the destruction of the temple. The Tanaim also are before the destruction of the temple, and then, in fact, is when Shammai and Hillel live. They live during the times of Bayit Sheni, and so their students also are living during the times of Bayit Sheni, but they're living in the latter portion of that time period. And so we're dealing with the century already under Roman rule when this is taking place, which in fact may be part of the reason about why they're meeting in the attic. Right? It could be there were times of persecution, maybe perhaps they didn't feel free to get together, and so they're hiding, they're meeting him in his attic. There's references in Sanhedrin of another similar story where they had to get together in an attic in order to pass certain laws. What's interesting is that within Megillat Tanit itself, it refers to that, no, it wasn't written by Hananiah, it was written by his son, Elazar ben Hananiah. He was the one who helped put together or to write down Megillat Ta'anit. And so some say that, you know what, they did it together, it was father and son, right? It was done over a period of time. But what some scholars have suggested, and this is interesting, is that Elazar ben Hananiah, ben Chizkiah ben Garon, that he is referred to in Josephus. He is referred to in the book of Josephus, and in Josephus, Elazar is referred to as one of the leaders of the Zealots. He's referred to as one of the leaders of those Jews who said, we need to fight. We need to overthrow Roman control. And so some say that why was Megillat Ta'anit written down? Written down by one of the heads of the Zealots? It was written down as a way of inspiring the people to look back and say, look at these collections of days. Look at all the victories. Look at the victories of the Maccabees. Look at the modern state of Israel. How much inspiration the early Zionists took from the Maccabees is saying, we are like the Maccabees, right? The few will be victorious over the many. And so that was the same attitude or same sense of pride that the Zealots took then as well. They said, you know what? We overthrew the Greeks. And you know what? We're going to overthrow the Romans as well. And it could be that's when, again, maybe these days were sort of observed already beforehand, but that's when it was written down. They published it together in a scroll that someone should open it up and see all those days together and to feel inspired that, you know what, we can do this, that we can be successful once again. And so this scroll is important besides for the dates, but the scroll is itself, what it represents, represented that last bit of hope of that time period at the end of Bayit Sheni, which really we're mourning over today. So it's during these days. So it's almost appropriate that we're discussing it now. And so that's part of the discussion as to exactly when it was written. Now, as far as the Hebrew part, which is written afterwards, so that clearly comes from a time after Bayit Sheni. And there's debate as to exactly who wrote it, when was it written. We have references to it in the Talmud, so it certainly already is around by the 4th, 5th century. But exactly when it was written, exactly who wrote it is a question. There are some variations within it. In fact, within scholarly circles, there are two versions of Megillat Tanit. They represent some different traditions. There's questions as perhaps there was an original and then things were added along and perhaps it was slightly corrupted. So we can't take everything 100% as it is within Megillat Tanit, but at the same time, it definitely gives you an inkling. It definitely gives us insight into that time period. And it is an important document because it tells us about the life. It tells us about the life of Bayit Sheni. It tells us about political issues. It tells us about military issues. It tells us about religious issues. And it all contained together. And so it's an important book to read because it does gives you a sense of that time period. What's uniquely important for us is that it gives us an insight from a vantage point that we can relate to because it comes from the tradition that Jews from that time forward followed as those who survived, that of the Purushim, that of the Pharisees. And so it's a meaningful study, and one of the things that we're going to see is particularly why it's so meaningful for us to study it, because of the appreciation it gives us about the way that history was viewed. And so that's what I want to do. I want to take some of the time that we have now to go through a couple of the days mentioned in there and to hopefully do that to show the importance of the study of history together with the study of this ancient source, both for what history tells us about these sources, but then ultimately what these sources tell us about Jewish history as well. Okay. So if you'll join me in source on page number 2, source number 6. This is in fact a source that we saw already earlier in one of the earlier classes when we were studying Josephus. And this is a date which is mentioned in Megillat Tanit. The date is actually, the quote I have over here is actually taken from the Talmud where it's referenced. The date is actually different from the date which is referred to in Megillat Tanit itself. In our version of Megillat Tanit, it says it's the 21st day of Kislev. Here it refers to it as the 25th day of Tevet. Again, not to get into all the scholarly issues as far as dating, but both events are recorded here. And as we saw then, this refers to an older, this predates the Maccabees. This talks about the encounter with Alexander the Great, with Alexander Smokdon, Alexander of Macedon, as it's referred to in the source. So this would be talking about the year 332 BCE. And it says over here, and what's important about the source also is that it also helps us engage one of the important issues in the book itself, which also is references to the Samaritans, to the Kutim, as well. It sort of pulls all of these together. So it says, why was this day made into a festival? Again, this is source number 6. It says, Yom Shabbat Shukutim et Beit Elokeinu, Alexander Smokdon, Lachruvo, Vednad Milahem. This is the day when the Kutim requested from Alexander the Great to destroy the Beis HaMikdash, and permission was granted to them. As the story goes, I'll read it and maybe somebody can do the translation. It says, Bo vidu et Shimon HaTzadik, I'll translate it. It says, they came and they told Shimon HaTzadik. Shimon HaTzadik is referred to as the high priest at that time. We discussed whether or not he was in fact the high priest at that time, but they came to one of the high priests. And Ma'asa, so what did he do? Lavash b'gdei kunah, b'yatef b'gdei kunah, b'mikre Yisrael imo. That they went out. He went out to meet him. That they went together. And they went to greet, they went to meet Alexander the Great. When they got there, this came unto Allah Amud Ashakar Amalahem. When they got there, they said, Mihalalu, who are these? They asked the Samaritans, hey, who are these other people that are coming to see us now? The Greeks said this. So Amru lo, they said to him, Yehudim Shemar Dubak, these are the Jews that have rebelled against you. Kevin Chigila Antipater, Zar Hakam Pablo Zebazeh, became light. They met up in Antipater, Caesarea, and that's where they're that area, and that's where they actually meet up. Kevin Sharal Shimon HaTzadik. Once Shimon HaTzadik saw the Kohen Gadol, Yara Mimer Kavto, Vishtaka Velafanav, he got off his chariot and bowed before the Kohen Gadol. Amrelo Melech Adol, Kmotcha Yishtaka Velihudizeh, said, with such a great, they said to him, why such a great king bowing down to this Jew? So Amrelo Hem, Dimuti Yochne Shalzeh, Minatzeka Lefanai Bebeit Milchamti, he says, I see an image of this person every time before I go to war. Umr, meaning I have a dream every night before I go to battle, and there's a man with a long white beard who comes to me and says, you'll be successful tomorrow. And he says, I never knew who that man was. But the man standing in front of me was that man. So Amar Lahem, so he said to them, Ramadatam, why have you come? So Amru Abshar Beit Mishalipalim Bo Alakha Alma Budha Shalotihara Nidavecha Gayim Mahribo. He says, would you give permission to Gentiles to destroy the house for which they pray for you? Meaning the temple. And again, you can see over here, those who are not Kutim are referred to as Yehudim, those who are Kutim are referred to as Goyim, as Gentiles. And so you really see that while they all identify as Jews, they really became two separate groups. And so Amar Lahem, so he says, Mihalalu, he says, who are these people that want to destroy your temple? So Amar Lahem, Kutim Halalu, Shavad Lachayim, he says, these Kutim, these people standing right here, it's a story of Purim, right? These people standing right here, these are the ones that want to do it. So Amar Lahem, he said to them, Arei he mesuram biyachem, he says, they are handed over to you. And as it continues, in fact, they go and they kill these Kutim who had tried to do this. And it says, Kevon she'ayu lahar Rizim, Karshu, Vizaru, Karshinim. When they reached Mount Rizim, that's what the Kutim said where the temple should be built. It says that they went and they destroyed the temple and they plowed it, they plowed the soil over. The Oto Hayam, Asuhu, Yom Tov. And that day, they instituted it as a day of festival. And so this is an important date which is referred to over here. This refers to a historical event, an account of Alexander the Great. We saw that it was found in Josephus as well. And so while it seems like somewhat a fantastic episode, could it possibly have occurred? We have two sources that give support for that event. In addition, this source also helps bring out the severe animosity between the Kutim and the rest of the Jewish population. And in fact, we have evidence that during the times of the Maccabees themselves, under Yochanan the Maccabee, the temple on Mount Gerizim really was destroyed by the rest of the Jewish population. And so it was a time of severe battling between these groups, and I wouldn't even call it infighting, because they really consider themselves to be two totally different traditions at that time already, to the point that they really viewed themselves to be true enemies. I don't think there was any saving face. There was no, let's be merciful. They really viewed each other as enemies by that period of time. And so that's one early reference that Megillat Tanit helps us understand, helps us get an appreciation for. What I want to look at now are two episodes that when you read them in here, that it's not so clear exactly what they're referring to. And so we're going to need to learn a little bit of history, and after we learn the history, then we'll read it again, and all of a sudden we'll realize, oh, that's what it means, that's what's going on over here. So let's just look at it quickly. It says, this is source 7, it says, V'ezim Timnei Beit Na'no Antiochus Malchum Yishlan, on the 20th day of Shabbat, King Antiochus was removed from Jerusalem. So Hayu Bushlayim, Vahayu Mitzarim, Lam Yisrael, because they were in Jerusalem, they made a siege on Israel, Lo Yachlu Atzeit V'Lavog Nehem V'Yom El Balayla. Jews couldn't get in and out. Shabbat Lachrit that Yishlayim, because he came to destroy Jerusalem, with a Hashmet at Kol HaYehudim, and to destroy the Jews, by Pilu Shemot Ra'ot, but he heard bad tidings, V'Halach Lo, but he returned, V'Nafal B'Mkomo, and he fell in his place, Yom Sheyatzim Hisham, the day in which the siege was broken, Asuhu Yom Tov, they made into a holiday. So, what's this referring to? Hanukkah, right? Who's talking about? Antiochus, right? Antiochus. So, not exactly true. It's close, but it's not exactly correct, because if I ask you, do you know the story from the story of Hanukkah with the siege on Yerushalayim? So what are you talking about? I don't know any story like this. So in fact, there's more to this episode, and we have to do a little bit of dating to get this. So it's a little bit confusing, so I'm going to write it down so that we're all on the same page. Okay. We celebrate Hanukkah as a great military victory, as a great success, a spiritual success. We think about it as one major battle. You know, the battle of the Jews against the Greeks, and we defeat them. But there were many battles. There were many battles that took place starting in 167 BCE, when the revolt began, until 165 BCE, when we actually successfully recapture Yerushalayim and we reinaugurate the temple. That's the date for when we celebrate Hanukkah. And then there were a number of battles that took place afterwards as well, until finally there was more of a lasting type of agreement that was reached. So it's many battles, but one particular battle that we celebrate of Hanukkah was the one where we captured Yerushalayim, but there were battles before and there were battles afterwards. In fact, there were four important battles that took place before the story of Hanukkah. The first battle took place from the Maccabees against the Greek soldiers that were stationed in Israel itself, right? In the garrisons in Israel. The second one is based on is a defeat against troops that come from Syria that were known as the Seleucids, the Greek Syrians. They defeat them in that second battle. There then was another battle, which was a major battle, a major force of troops that came from Syria, which were defeated. And then once again, another major force that was sent from Syria, which was defeated as well. There's talks about 100,000 Syrian troops killed. Major, major victories. After that, Judah the Maccabee goes into Yerushalayim, rededicates the temple, finds the oil, the story of Hanukkah. Before the third battle, Antiochus, who we all know of the story of Hanukkah, decides he needs to go to Persia. Why does he go to Persia? He needs money. So he leaves, he goes to Persia to fundraise, meaning to rob the temples, and he leaves in charge Lysias. He leaves Lysias in charge of his son, Antiochus. That's the way they did it back then, right? Everyone was named after the father. So the Antiochus that we're familiar with is known as Antiochus the Fourth. Antiochus, Antiochus the Fourth, Epiphanes, the Great. We refer to him in history as Epimanes, the Crazy. But that was him. His son is Antiochus the Fifth. Okay, so I'm going to write some names down because it's going to get confusing. Okay, so here we have Antiochus the Fourth, and then we have Antiochus the Fifth. Okay.
Does this information come from Maccabees?
This is right. This is based on Book of Maccabees, based on Josephus. Okay. At that point, so he goes off to Persia. While in Persia, he hears of the defeats. He hears about what's happening in Judea, and apparently he falls into depression, and he dies. He dies in Persia. The famed Antiochus, that's where he finally dies. He doesn't die in battle against the Maccabees. He dies in Persia. Before he dies, he tells his assistant, Philip, I want you to raise my son, Antiochus the Fifth. Okay, so you can sort of see that there are now two people who have a sense that they've been left in control. Lysias was left in control when Antiochus left. Antiochus IV left for Persia. But before he dies, he tells his assistant Philip, I want you to raise my son. Now, why is it important who's been put in charge of raising the son?
Because
he's ruler. Until the son grows up, that's the guy who's in charge. Now, the Maccabees, as we mentioned, after the story of the victories, they begin attacking not only the Greeks, but they, at that point, begin attacking those who supported the Greeks, the Mityavnim, the Jews who supported the Syrian Greeks. And they're killing many Jews who've taken refuge in the various, in the Akra, which is found in Jerusalem. Some of them get out and go back to Syria to ask for support. So look in source 9 over here. This is a quote from the Book of Maccabees. It says, now the men of the citadel kept hemming Israel in around the sanctuary. They were trying every way to harm them and strengthen the Gentiles. So Judah decided to destroy them. He said, enough with this, little battles here and there. Let's destroy them. And assemble all the people to besiege them. They gathered together and besieged the citadel in the 150th year and built the siege towers and other engines of war. But some of the garrison escaped from the siege and some of the ungodly Israelites joined them. They went to the king and said, they went back to Syria and said, how long will you fail to do justice and to avenge our brethren? We were happy to serve your father. Who's the father? Antiochus the Fourth. So they're talking about Antiochus the Fifth. To live by what he said and to follow his commands. For this reason, the sons of, turn the page, for this reason, the sons of our people besieged the citadel and became hostile to us. That's why the other Jews are attacking us. Moreover, they have put to death many of us as they have caught, and they have seized our inheritances. And not against us alone have they stretched our hands, but also against all the lands on their borders. And behold, today they have camped against the citadel and Jerusalem to take it, and they fortified both the sanctuary and Beit Tzur. That was an important complex. Unless you quickly prevent them, they will do still greater things, and you will not be able to stop them. The king was enraged when he heard this. He summoned all his friends, the commanders of his forces, and those in authority. So he, Lysias, then responds by putting together an army of over 100,000 troops. And he, together with Antiochus V, come down to Jerusalem. And he has great success. He has great success against them. But as it's the sabbatical year, why is it important that it's the year of Shemitah? There's not so much food, right? There's not so much food in Shemitah year. The fields are being laid fallow. People, he lays a siege on Jerusalem, and the people are starving. But let's see what happens. Look, let's read in source 10. Can somebody read source 10, please? Thanks.
10.
Summer?
The Jews were also made entrance of war to Mount Zed and forced to many days. But they had no food in store because it was the seventh year. Those who found safety in the day from the Gentiles had consumed the last of the stores. Few men were left in the sanctuary because famine had prevailed over the rest and they had been scattered, each to his own place. Then Lysias heard that Philip, whom King Antiochus while still living had appointed to bring up Antiochus' son to the king, had returned from Persia and Medea with the forces that had gone with the king, and that he was trying to seize control of the government. So he quickly gave orders to depart and said to the king, to the commanders of the forces and to the men, "We daily grow weaker, our food supply is dead, the place against which we are fighting is strong, and the affairs of the kingdom press urgently upon us. Now that I have come to terms with these men, make peace with them and their nation, and have raised them to live by their laws as they did before. For it was on account of their laws that we abolished that they became angry and did all those things."
Okay, so what happens? So Lysias is making this attack on Jerusalem. He hears that Philip has come back. Philip is coming back and he says, "I'm in charge." Lysias says, "I don't think so." So he quickly makes a peace treaty with the Jews and says, "Let's make a peace treaty. We officially rescind all of our laws against you." And he goes back right before he really, at least on this account, was going to have a victory over Jerusalem because the people inside were in fact starving to death. Let's look back now and read the source again. Look at source number 7. It says, "On the 28th day of Shabbat, King Antiochus was removed from Jerusalem." Which King Antiochus?
The fifth.
Antiochus Eupator. For he tyrannized Israel and came to destroy Jerusalem and to exterminate the Jews. Jews are able to come and go only at night. Why? There was a siege, right? That's what we read. But he heard bad tidings. What were the bad tidings?
Philip
came back. He left and fell in his place. We'll refer to that later. That day in which they eliminated him from there, they, the sages, designated a festival. So first of all, if you really understand this explanation, if you know the history first, because if not, you just read it and you don't know what's going on. So this, first of all, helps us appreciate the importance of history and understanding certain aspects of our tradition. What I think it also is important, this is why it's so significant, is once you read about what happened, it's significant that they decided to make this into a festival. Because you could read this and say, why is this a festival? He had to go back and fight. This is not a day of celebration or religious holiday, but that's not the way that the rabbis viewed it. They said no. The fact that things played out the way they did was a blessing from God. It wasn't simply Philip came back and Lysias had to leave and just that's the way the world works sometimes. They said, no, this was a miracle that God occurred to take place, and so they established it as a holiday. And so I think that's important for the way that that we see the way that the rabbis at that time, the way that they viewed history, that they didn't view it just as a series of random events, but they in fact viewed them as days which would be appropriate to give thanks to God for. They viewed them as having a religious nature. Okay, that's what, yeah, go ahead.
So according to the Maccabees, it was Lysias who was laying siege and then left.
Right. But he was the king, meaning he was in charge of the king. He was in charge of Antiochus, so it's the same.
I thought Antiochus was with Philip.
No, Antiochus had been left in Syria. Philip had gone to Persia with Antiochus the IV.
Right.
He then was told, go back to Syria and raise my son. But in the meantime, Lysias had gone down with the king to Jerusalem to try to defeat the Maccabees. Okay? Yes? Meaning we can take inspiration from this. Yeah, I mean, it's a whole logically complicated issue with Sanballat, not how that's another discussion, but there are important, certainly this is a place for inspiration. Let's go, check out the next source is amazing. It says, on the 13th day of Adar is the day of Nicanor. They, the sages, said, Nicanor is one of the nobles of the Greek kings, and every day he would wave his hand toward Jerusalem in the holy temple and blaspheme, accuse, abuse, and say, when will they fall into my hands, so that I will demolish this power? When the noble house of the Hasmoneans gained power and defeated the Greeks, they penetrated his armies and killed them until they reached his chariot. They cut off his head and the fingers of his hands and the feet and hung them opposite the gates of Jerusalem, rope beneath them, the mouth that spoke heartily and the hands that waved at Jerusalem and the holy temple. This is the vengeance inflicted upon them. Harsh. Right. Okay, so what exactly is going on here? What is the story that's taking place? So again, need a little bit of background to appreciate that what's going on. So we spoke about the Seleucids, right? The Syrian Greeks, the Greeks who live in Syria, that they were in control over Judea. They had not always been over control over Judea. When Alexander the Great conquered in 332 BCE, it was one unified Greek kingdom. 323 BCE, Alexander the Great dies. His kingdom splits into three, two important ones, the Ptolemies in Egypt and the Seleucids in Syria. At first, it's the Ptolemies that are in control over Judea, and they remain in control for 100 years until about the year 200 BCE, when finally one of the Seleucid kings is able to wrestle control over Judea from the Ptolemies. The name of that king is Seleucus. Right? It's a very, it's a good name. Seleucus III, and he becomes king. Now, one of the mistakes that he makes is that he continues, he feels, I'm being so successful, so he continues to spread his army, and he decides he's going to go west as well. Now, if you know history, by the year 190 BCE, you start spreading west, you're going to come into contact with a new the new gang in town. Who's he going to bump into? Going west. He's going west from Syria. The Romans. He's no match for the Romans. The Romans defeat him. They say, you can remain in control, but you have to pay us a yearly tax. And so he has to pay a tax. And in addition to paying a yearly tax to the Romans, he also, the law is that one of the family members of the king of this dynasty has to always be imprisoned at Rome. And it was on a rotation, but that was a way of making sure that they wouldn't try to start up with the Romans, because they say, listen, if you start up with us, we're going to kill the heir to the throne. Okay? So Seleucus has two sons. Seleucus has two sons. One of his sons is guess what? Is Seleucus the IV. Okay? He has another son. Who's his other son? Antiochus the IV. Right? Antiochus the IV. He's also his king. Upon the death of Seleucus, the eldest son, Seleucus the IV, takes over. That's 187 BCE. Now at that time, and he rules until 175 BCE, okay? So he rules from 187 to 175. Okay. Now at that point, while he's in control, in 175 BCE, one of the people that had been in prison is Antiochus. In 175, Antiochus returns, and who goes in his place to Rome? Seleucus' son, whose name is? Demetrius. I set you up. So, At that point, Antiochus takes over, and he rules from 175 BCE forward. Right? He rules forward. So what happens? He dies, right? Antiochus takes over. Demetrius is over there. Now, finally, in 162 BCE, Demetrius, this is after the story of Hanukkah, 165 BCE, Demetrius escapes from Rome. Demetrius escapes from Rome. Now, first of all, by the way, when Lysias went back to Syria, when he heard the bad tidings, what did he do? What would he do? He kills Philip, right? So Philip is out of the question. Lysias and now Antiochus the Fifth, or now let's just say Antiochus the Fifth, he's in charge. He's in charge when, because he, remember, we said he dies, let's say around 165 BCE. So from 165 forward, he's in charge. 162 comes around, he gets out, he escapes from Rome, and he says, "You're in charge. I'm in charge." He says, "My father was king before your father's king. I should be the one that's ultimately in control." So what does he do? So what does he do? He kills him. Right? He kills him. And so he takes over in 162 BCE. Okay. Okay. He then goes ahead and says, it's time to recapture Judea. It's time to recapture Judea. And so he sends his greatest general. Guess what his general's name is? Nicanor. He sends Nicanor. So let's read the next source. Look in source 11. Source 11, page 4, it says, after these events, Nicanor went up to Mount Zion. Some of the priests came out of the sanctuary and some of the elders of the people to greet him peaceably and to show him the burnt offerings, that which had been offered for the king. But he mocked them and derided them, this is the Book of Maccabees, and defiled them and spoke arrogantly. And in anger he swore his oath, unless Judah's army are delivered into my hands this time, then if I return safely, I will burn up this house. And he went out in great anger. And the priests went in and stood before the altar in the temple, and they wept and said, thou did choose this house to be called by thy name, right? They're talking, they're praying to gods, and to be for thy people, has a prayer and supplication. Take vengeance on this man and on his army, and let them fall by the sword. Remember their blasphemies, and let them live no longer. Let's look back now in source number 8, Megillat Ta'anit. On the 13th day of Adar is the day of Nicanor. They, the sages, said Nicanor was one of the nobles of the Greek kings. Which Greek king?
Demetrius.
Every day he would wave his hand toward Jerusalem and the holy temple and blaspheme, accuse, abuse, and say, as we saw in the Book of Maccabees as well, when will they fall into my hands so that I will demolish this tower? When the noble house of the Hasmoneans gained power and defeated them, they penetrated his armies and killed them until they reached his chariots, and we know the rest. And so here, again, we have another example of, if you would just read Megillah on its own, probably wouldn't be so easy to identify exactly what it's referring to, what was going on. With the aid of other historical sources, books of the Apocrypha, like the Book of Maccabees, works like Josephus, enables us to understand the history so that we can understand the source of the rabbis. Now, besides for just interesting to know the history, I think once we know the history, again, it helps us understand the rabbis. It helps us understand Judaism, because again, we see that they designate, they appreciate it, that this should be a day of celebration. That they identified that this wasn't simply a military victory. This just wasn't just some success on the battlefield, but they identified this as a day of celebration for the Jewish people, as a day to give thanks to God. And I think because of that, these sources become important, because they really give us an insight into the way that Judaism views history from a very ancient time, from over 2,000 years ago. And for that reason alone, this is an important work from a Jewish perspective, one in part for history, but also in part for understanding Jewish attitudes towards, well, they no longer exist, so it doesn't matter so much, but Tzedukin, what's matter is there's about a couple hundred of them still living in Israel, but more importantly, for the way that we view history, and we viewed historical events, and we didn't view them simply as things that happened, but we viewed them as acts of God. What I just want to sort of finish up with is, what's interesting is that you know, I don't know about you, I mean, I don't really fast so much in general, but we don't have 36 days on our calendar that we don't observe. Now, certain days of Megillat Tanit continue to be celebrated, those are days like Hanukkah. At Hanukkah, we still celebrate. We still celebrate Purim. Right? There are certain days that are continued to be days of celebration, but besides for that, none of them are celebrated anymore. And the question is, why? What exactly happened? So let's look at the back page, in source number 12. I'm going to read in English. The Gemara is talking over there about certain fast days. Fast days like Shavasar B'Tamas, Asara B'Tevis, fast days that commemorate days that impacted the destruction of the temple. And the Gemara says that the only times when those days are observed are times when the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed. When the Beis HaMikdash is built, those days are not observed. So during the time of Bayit Sheni, those events which commemorate the destruction of Bayit Rishon, that we commemorate today, were not commemorated. They were not observed during the Second Temple period. After the destruction of the Second Temple, that's when they were reinstituted, and we began fasting on them again. So they then have a question, well, what about Megillat Tanit? So it says, Rav and Rav Chanina say, Megillat Tanit was abrogated. Rav Yochanan and Rav Yeshua ben Levi say, Megillat Tanit was not abrogated. So Rav and Rav Chanina say, Megillat Tanit was abrogated. Why? That is to say that at a time when there is peace, they, the fast days, will be for joy and happiness. Meaning, when the Beis HaMikdash is rebuilt, we will not have the fast days of Sar B'Days and Shavasar B'Tamuz. And when there is no peace, they will be fast days, like we currently, unfortunately, find ourselves in. And they say, and so too, these festival days, the days of Megillat Tanit, are like those, that at times of happiness, they are observed, and in times of sadness, times when we don't have the Beis HaMikdash, they're not observed. And therefore, he says, we no longer observe Megillat Tanit, because we're not so happy anymore, right? We're not going to celebrate the victories of the Maccabees and over the Sadducees anymore because we're in Galut, we're in exile now. We don't feel the celebration. Yochanan and Yeshua and Levi say, no, Megillat Tanit was not abrogated. For those fast days alone did the Merciful One make dependent on the building of the Holy Temple, meaning those fast days depend on whether the temple is built or not, but they exist, they have always existed, but these exist. These days, he says, should continue. We should continue to observe the holidays of Megillat Ta'anit. We should continue to not recognize them as fasted. Now, what's interesting about this dispute is it means that at least until the time of this dispute, there were those that were still observing these days. When do these rabbis live? This is Rav. Rav is one of the authors of the Mishnah. We're talking about the 3rd century of the Common Era, was when these days were still being accepted as days of somewhat of festivals. After that time period, it seems perhaps because of the statement of Rav, or just why not, that really we stopped celebrating them because we're in Galut, we're not going to continue to celebrate these old days. Certain particularly important ones, like Hanukkah, that we do, but the other ones we do not. The Gemara discussion about why Hanukkah says, because Hanukkah had with it the concept of publicizing a great miracle for Sumenisa that had the mitzvah of lighting a menorah, so that one maintained, but the other ones fell to the side. What's interesting is that it does remain, though, to some degree, according to some opinions. The next comment is the Tor. The Tor is written in the 14th century. We'll learn about it next year in Svarim Bashana. He writes, the law of the Megillat Tanit was abrogated. For all the days that are written in Megillat Tanit during which one should not fast, one is permitted to fast nowadays, aside from Hanukkah and Purim. The Ravid writes that only an individual is permitted to fast them, but a community still cannot enact a fast on those days. It's according to this opinion, even today, if we wanted as a community to establish a fast day, it would not be appropriate to fast on the days that are mentioned in Megillat Tanit. What? Right, so again, whether we actually practice this is not necessarily the case. What ultimately comes out is there are a number of these, just give me a bear for one more moment, this is a particularly meaningful book as Jews to study because it has so much content, I think, for Jewish history, but as we saw, or for Jewish religion, those are all the books that we looked at, well, not all of them necessarily have a religious nature for us today. We don't continue to celebrate them as part of Tanakh or as part of our religious tradition, but they do share with us great insight into that period of time. It was a period of turmoil, but a time also of perhaps the development or the identity of what Judaism ultimately would be after the times of the Korban, when the Purushim turned into all of us today. So the study of the books, in fact, does enrich our understanding of that time period, but also does give us great insight into Judaism as it's practiced today. I hope that you all enjoyed. I had a great time learning with you. Next Wednesday night, in-depth look at the story of Gan Eden. Next year, Tanakh and Shrine B'Shanah. Take advantage. Take advantage. It's going to be great. Sign up. Okay.
Next
one. Yes, sir.